This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 307, where CJ and I are going to sit down and talk about clear and stormy cloud news updates, recorded live June the 13th, 2019. For those of us familiar with ShareGate, we know that they've always been about SharePoint and Office 365 migration. But now that we've all moved to the cloud, like me, you're probably thinking, how about how to scale your Office 365 to a full self-serve environment without worrying about thousands of groups and teams popping up out of nowhere, aka sprawl? That's why the folks at ShareGate developed ShareGate Apricot. It's a solution that helps us automate our Office 365 groups governance by allowing us to collaborate with users to keep everyone accountable for the things they create. Their super simple to use in-app experience lets us lighten our load by delegating group management responsibilities to users we trust, aka no more sprawl. Want to get your hands on ShareGate Apricot? Try it for free for 30 days at ShareGate.com/collegeshow. Hey man, how's it going?
I am okay. I've got a little bit of a cold, but on the whole, not too bad. How are you?
I'm better. I did have a cold. I appreciate you flying solo last week with Bill Bear, but I'm still short-winded. I still may cough a little bit through this, but yeah, last week I canceled the second time ever. It's always been a fear of mine with the work that we do where you do teach, go speak at conferences, whatever. And it was the second time I have ever had to cancel a business trip at the last minute because of an illness or something. It was out of control. Yeah. I literally was packed up and I canceled 2 hours before my flight left. And I was like, you know what? I cannot get on a plane for 6 hours with the amount of pressure that's in my head right now. I'll blow an eardrum.
Yeah. I mean, you were coming out this way, right? And so it was a long way to fly. And yeah, probably the right call for sure.
Yeah. I got even worse like later on in the day. And finally, I remember sitting there on the couch. Meredith looked over at me at one point, like 8 o'clock at night. And she goes, God, you look like absolute crap or something like that.
Yeah.
And you look like you're in so much pain. And I'm like, and right now I would have an additional 3 hours left on my flight to Seattle.
Brutal, like, brutal.
Oh.
Okay. So this might make you feel a little better about spending time on planes or lack thereof. This weekend, I went down to LA, flew down Saturday morning, flew back Sunday night to meet up with a couple of my mates. So we went to LA, one of whom lives in San Francisco. So he flew up for the night. Mm-hmm. And the other one lives in New Zealand and he flew over for the night.
For the night?
So we both arrived in LA at about 11 a.m. on Saturday morning. We went to our hotel, we hung out by the pool, we had good manly gossip session by the pool and a few cocktails. Then we went out to dinner. Then we went out clubbing. We stayed out rather late. We had breakfast in the morning. We went to Santa Monica in the afternoon, hung out at the beach all day. And then I got on a flight back to Seattle. My other friend got on a flight back to San Francisco and my other friend got on a flight to New Zealand. So people are like, you came over for the night. Yep. But we made we made it worth it.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like it.
I like to say we were hanging out. I was hanging out for dinner with Drake and Tobey Maguire and Natalie Portman. But really, what I mean by that was they were sitting at the table next to me. Not together. Tobey Maguire and Drake weren't hanging out together. They were on opposite sides of our table. But it was pretty, pretty entertaining. We did the full Hollywood thing. We went to dinner in Hollywood, saw the celebs, and went out to this club afterwards that the Kardashians were partying at. We got the full LA Hollywood experience. It was pretty entertaining.
Oh, man. That's cool.
Yeah, it was really good. But I hardly get to see these guys. And so when we do get together, it's usually only for a night. And so we make it worthwhile.
Make it a top night.
Yeah. So if it makes you feel better about spending time on planes, my friend flying from New Zealand and then back within a 24-hour period.
Yeah, the part that kind of rubbed it in was yesterday I got the, from Delta, I got my card, my 1 million miler status card.
Oh, brutal.
You open it up and you're like, huh.
Is that a reward or a reminder?
you want to hear about, so there was a reward. Do you want to hear what the reward was? This is a little off color, but it's a funny story. Okay. So
sure.
You get an email and it's like, hey, you got a million miler status. Thank you very much. We do a gift for our million milers. Click this link and select what you want. So I went and looked at it and I'm like, I don't want any of this stuff. So let me call my wife. So it was, you could choose from a new suitcase from Samsonite, which we just got new luggage. And so I was like, I don't want to do that. You could get like, not luggage, but like travel. It's like the travel bullshit things, like, you know, from Tumi. So it's like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
get like this little inner bag that you put in your bigger bag. Like, what the fuck would I, what, sorry, why would I do that? So there was that option. And then there was stuff from Tiffany's. So it was a little stuff from Tiffany. So, of course, Meredith comes up. I look at her and say, you know, do you see anything here that you want? And she's like, can I get something different? I'm like, no, this, you have to choose from the options they give us. And so she chose two little silver spheres that are earrings.
Yep.
She chose those. So they showed up, opened up, called up to my office. I was like, hey, come on up here. I got something for you. She comes up here. I give it to her. And I said, now you officially have my balls.
Nice. There you go.
And she has been showing them off to everybody the last few days.
It gets better. But they're tiny by the sounds of it.
Well, yeah. Oh,
let's not get into this further, but I couldn't help myself with that. But yeah.
Hey, CJ, did you watch the last episode of Chernobyl?
I did. I really enjoyed this miniseries. I thought it was great.
Did you listen to all the podcasts along with it?
Yeah, I did. I thought that was actually, that was what really made it for me, was listening to the podcasts that go along with each episode, because there was so much great backstory and I loved hearing what they decided to cut, like some of the scenes that they shot but that they didn't put in, some of the other backstory behind the characters and some of the stories and how it all came to be. I thought it was really interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like in how they used, I completely agree. I didn't listen to it until after I had watched the entire series. I had somebody told me that it was two people. It was the writer for that did the screenplay. And it was the, it was Peter Sagal, who's the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for NPR.
Yeah.
If someone had told me that that's who was on the show, I probably would have listened to it sooner.
Yeah.
But
it's so well done.
I agree. It was so well done. And it was, the editing was well done. There's a book I'm listening to right now that's kind of like in the same vein. Are you familiar with a guy named David Goggins?
Yeah, the name rings a bell. Yeah.
He's a former Navy SEAL and he was in a, it was one of my picks, or I was going to make it my pick today, but he was he's a Navy SEAL and I just blanked on the guy, but there was another book that I picked called like 30 Days with a SEAL or Living with a SEAL for 30 Days or something like that, where this guy, he runs a company. You'd be totally familiar with the company. But he, you didn't know who the SEAL was, but he kind of lived with him and just did all of his workouts and everything. And then David Goggins wrote a book about You Can't Hurt Me and just his life story. I'm about halfway through it, but what's interesting about it is that what they did for the audio podcast is that, or for the audio version of the book, is you've got the original writer, the ghostwriter for the book, is the one that's reading it back to you. And then a couple times, definitely between each chapter, and then sometimes in the middle of the chapter, they stop and he talks to David about some of the things that were going on. So it's kind of like it's kind of like watching the Chernobyl episode, a series, and then interspliced with the podcast inside. It's really good. It's a really, it's a really cool way to do this, because you can get, it's like getting the director's cut while you're actually getting the story. And it's really insightful.
Yeah. No, I thought it was really well produced podcast, and also just, yeah, getting all of that background was fantastic.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I loved it. I thought it was great. I mean, I've nerded out on, you know how you go deep on the internet sometimes and you're like starting to read about stuff. Chernobyl's one of those things I've gone nerded out about in the past, but it's been a while, and you go down the hole, you end up like reading all of the translated reports about what happened and the official reports. And then you go into read the 3 Mile Island version and what happened there and all that sort of stuff. So it was nice to see it all come together. And I thought they were very true to my understanding anyway. So yeah, it sounded good.
It's funny you did that. I mean, we were just talking about the show, how we both have like, you know, same mindset about certain topics and stuff. And I was the same thing. I sat down and I watched two 1-hour documentaries about Fukushima and 3 Mile Island last week. And it was just eating it up. And like, just trying to learn more about it. Is you get the stuff that the media talks about and it's always topical and they never go deep enough. Yeah. And then once there's the real research to it, it's like, now tell me the story of what happened and the details. Of, I want to know why. And that was the part that I thought that was the coolest part about Chernobyl. The very end of it, episode 5, which, I'm sorry, spoiler everybody, it melts down. But the...
Next you're going to tell me the Titanic sinks. Thanks, AC.
Yeah, well, it slipped into the deep and broke in half. And a little more detail for you. Sorry. I thought the way that they did the what, the why, and the how, or the what, the what, the why, and the how for Chernobyl with the trial. And yeah, it was a creative license that they took, but it was still factual to what, yeah, it's factual to what happened to Chernobyl, but it's not factual to the trial. But the way it was presented in the trial, it was such a good way. And I, when you look back, I was like, I can't believe they explained that entire thing in 1 hour. And I got all of that information out of it in that 1 hour. I thought it was just such a...
That's a real art, right? Like, that's the real art to storytelling, is being able to have Joe Schmo understand it when it, you're talking about such a complicated topic. And I think they did a fantastic job of that.
Agreed. Yeah, I thought they did a great job. But, well, want to dive into some news? We got some stormy news, some cloudy news, some Microsoft news, some Slack news.
Sounds good.
We got to get going. So let's go ahead and get started. But first, before we do that, let's hear from one of our fantastic sponsors who helps put makes this show possible.
Struggling to reproduce problems in your code base? Successful software starts with Raygun. Raygun provides application performance monitoring, unlike anything that you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one place. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun for free at raygun.com today.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
All right, CJ, I got a link here. I'm gonna start with a little bit of a cloudy, some stormy cloudy news.
Daniels, like actually cloud news. Okay, got it.
No, this is bad news. So I found this article on The Register. Developers slam Microsoft for injecting tech support scam ads into their Windows Store apps. And Redmond just shrugged after advertising systems sling all the stuff at users. So here's what happened. You know how like on these different ad platforms, like iOS has one, Microsoft has one, that in a way to get paid in your apps or to generate revenue for your apps is to utilize their ad platform and let the platform go through and put ads in instead of you trying to go through and sell the ads.
Yes.
So what happened was that there's a thread in Microsoft's support forum that has been active since late April that developers who use Redmond's advertising software development kit to display ads in their apps were getting banners for bad things were showing up in their ads. And the bad thing is that the things that were showing up were all like scam ads. So these were people who downloaded their apps are being interrupted by their browsers opening up new tabs displaying alarming messages that wrongly claim their PC is infected or damaged, and then directing the scammer owned to a scammer owned website that offers to fix this supposedly broken machine for cash. It affects Xbox One owners who also used it to employ the SDK as well. And the bad part is that while Redmond did, Microsoft did provide a temporary workaround and then suggested they open up a paid support contract to fix the problem, they basically just shrugged their shoulders and didn't really do a whole lot about it. And I don't know what the final result is on it, but Microsoft basically at the very end of it just said, quote, Microsoft does not send unsolicited messages to request personal or financial information to provide technical support or to fix your computer or to send intimidating alerts when threats take action. If you receive unsolicited messages or you see a pop on your computer, don't take the risk. Just close your browser. And it's like,
that's not the point, you muppet.
Exactly. This one developer, this is a great way to say it. This is killing the user experience for any app that uses Microsoft's advertising SDK. How do you expect users to trust anything using an app on any Microsoft store when they keep having browser popped open with an obvious scam site?
All of these things, this is all beyond the point. The point is, how the hell is Microsoft letting these people advertise?
Yep.
The whole, you shouldn't click on things. No Sherlock, right?
Yep.
Right? And then, but the horse is bolted, dude. Why are you letting the horse line up in the gates to begin with? Right? Mm-hmm. Why is Microsoft letting these people advertise? Besides the point, besides what actually happens when the ad goes out, how are they letting the ad get out through their system to begin with?
It's just wrong.
That's the point, right? They should not let that happen. Who cares about pop-ups? Like, it's not ideal, right? But they should be stopping people from advertising that are trying to scam people. Like, that's, that's really bad. Telling people, you know, take vitamins after the fact is not ideal.
No.
You got another one?
I have another one that's another stormy one. We've harped on other companies, you know, when their clouds go down. And I think last one episode, like two episodes ago, I went kind of eight blank on Microsoft or Azure AD again.
Yeah.
Which I could do again, but I won't do it now. That the Google Cloud had a huge networking incident that on, let's see, this was on June the 2nd, and it looks like it lasted for about 4 hours. They issue summary of it. They experienced elevated packet loss as a result of network congestion for a duration between 3 hours and 19 minutes and 4 hours and 25 minutes. I'm not really sure how there's a duration there, but the duration and the degree of the packet loss vary considerably from region to region. And to explain the details below, well, there's a whole root cause and remediation. But a lot of things were, it seems like a lot of things were actually affected. Customers may have experienced increased latency, internet errors, connectivity losses to instances in US Central 1, US East 1, US East 4, US West 2, North America, Northeast 1, South America, East 1, and cloud instances in all, the only ones that were not affected, US West 1, all European and all Asian regions.
Ouch.
So, yeah, and it looks like it affected everything. Google Compute Engine, App Engine, Cloud Endpoints, Cloud Interconnect, Cloud VPN, Cloud Console, Stackdriver Metrics, Cloud Pub Sub, BigQuery, Regional Cloud Spanner Instances, Cloud Storage, Regional Buckets, and G Suite. Whoa.
Ouchie. Yeah, this looks like it started, user impact started at 11:47 a.m. Pacific time, U.S. Pacific time, and full service was resumed at 4:10 p.m. U.S. Pacific time. That's quite a while.
You know, I got to give it to them, though. The update that they provide here, they do a much better job of publishing this update than I've seen with Azure. This is, we've got a deep link straight to the issue. You got the issue summary and the root cause and remediation and prevention and follow-up. All that stuff that Microsoft does a similar thing except for the deep link, making it easy. But the detailed description of the impact, they go through each individual service and talk about like Compute Engine in this region was up 33% of packet loss from 11:38 to 12:17 and 8% from 12:17 to 2:50. It's this kind of detail and transparency. I got to give it to them. This is as pretty. And then plus you've got the entire history of the issue and how it was all the updates and stuff. It's really well reported.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, the write-up looks great. Just skimming it, it's very detailed. It's nice.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay, on to some cloudy news.
Yep.
Big news of the week, obviously, was Salesforce bought or is buying Tableau for $15.7 billion.
Yep.
Just when you thought house prices in Seattle couldn't get any worse, all of the Tableau stockholders will now be buying up lots and lots of property, and billions of dollars will be flowing into the Seattle real estate market, making them even less affordable. This is a thing. So whenever acquisitions are announced, house prices skyrocket because of the money flowing into the market. And suddenly you've got all of those people that had stock options in Tableau and all the investors and all the founders, because Tableau is local, flowing into the market, and suddenly they're all cashed up and they start buying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so real estate agents, I've got a friend who's an agent who said it's noticeable. There's a noticeable uptick in prices after an acquisition goes through.
Really? That's fascinating.
A big acquisition, one that will make a meaningful impact to the market. Yeah.
Yeah. This is an interesting purchase by them too. I mean, it's interesting to see what they've, how this is going to play. I mean, Tableau is it's a pretty impressive product. I mean, I guess it's, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a compete to Power BI, I guess would be a good way to look at it.
I'm pretty sure they would argue that they don't compete with Power BI.
Well, yeah. Okay. So that's the other thing I say.
But they say some of the same words. How about that?
I saw someone describe it as like Dynamics is for people who can't afford Salesforce and Power BI is for people who can't afford Tableau, where Tableau is, Power BI doesn't have all the features that Tableau has. I don't know the details around it, but
I think that's legitimate. Tableau actually costs quite a lot of money to get going. So yeah, that seems reasonable. There's something more to this than just the acquisition, I think, that Salesforce missed out on buying LinkedIn from Microsoft. Mm. And apparently Benioff was pissed about it. Mm-hmm. And this is cocking a leg and taking a whiz on a power pole in Microsoft's backyard, right? This is hoovering up hundreds and hundreds of engineers and talent in a region of the country where Salesforce has not been well-known, not well-known, but doesn't have a large established presence, right? So I think a little bit of the backstory of this as well is Benioff getting back, a little bit of getting back against Satya for stealing LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't think it's a great deal for Salesforce. I think it probably is, but I think it probably makes them feel a bit better knowing that it's in Seattle and it's in Microsoft's backyard as well.
Yeah. And for those of you who aren't familiar, Benioff is the CEO. Mark Benioff is the CEO of Salesforce.
Yes.
But yeah, it's interesting. It is a hell of a purchase. Man, these acquisitions that are like, I don't know if you feel like, is it a getting old kind of a thing too? But you just, everybody, you look at every acquisition these days and it's like this many billions and this many billions. It's like, it's just crazy, the value of some of these things.
A lot of money flowing around.
Yeah. But it's not even real money too. I mean, it's a lot of stock stuff. So it's not even like, it's still like funny money. I mean, it's real money, but it's not real money.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense. But it makes sense to me. So I'm good. And yeah, I got the microphone right now. So I'm good. Yep.
Yeah. So they have 1,000 people in Seattle and 4,200 people worldwide. So obviously they will be landing more of those people in Seattle, I guess. Yeah, taking all those people in Seattle and landing more of their own presence in Seattle. Be interesting.
I'm curious to see how they integrate that with their existing Salesforce stuff. I mean, I would assume that it would stay independent as an independent product that they could still sell. What about being able to take some of that information and now have tight integration with Salesforce? That could be really powerful.
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't realize that they've been around since 2003.
Tableau has?
Yeah.
Huh. I know they used it. They used it a lot when I was doing stuff with Pluralsight. They used a lot of Tableau to kind of show us a lot of metrics and stuff of what we were doing. But yeah. I'm still having my fun with Power BI right now. I'm enjoying it, but I still have this like I don't know what to do in certain situations. I need a Jason Himmelstein on one corner, on one shoulder, and a John White on the other shoulder. The problem is,
dude, be careful what you wish for.
Oh my God, my back would be killing me. Like, just two people sitting on me. Like, these guys, I want to like carve out so much time with them when we talk about this stuff. But at any rate, hey, did you pay attention to any of the stuff that happened at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference at the beginning of June?
Not in any great detail, no.
Okay. There wasn't anything like too epic. Nice updates to the watch, nice updates to the iPad that are coming in iOS, nice updates to macOS that are coming. But there were two things I thought that stood out. One, of course, everybody talks about is the $1,000 monitor stand, which is just is just comedy. I love the fact that Apple's getting reamed for it.
I love it. I like that's definitely stupid tax.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. But the thing that I found I wanted to highlight here, which is kind of cloudy, the cloudy news, is it's an article by TechCrunch. And they do a really good summary of what Apple announced. But the article is Apple is now the privacy as a service company. And what they did there, I mean, Apple is really big on privacy. And I think of all the companies that are out there, Apple might do, well, they seem to do the one of, if not the most, where they're one of some of the most around privacy. So making it to where, you know, you're locking your phone down even more to where nobody can go through and hack it, not even Apple. So like to really combat what they believe privacy is a right and they don't, law enforcement should be able to have it or be able to hack your phone without your consent. One thing that they announced is, it's interesting, is they've created a new thing called Sign In with Apple. And what this does now, so this is going to be required. It's a cool concept. It's an interesting concept. It is any app that you have on your phone that allows you to do federated auth with, like, say, Facebook or Twitter, they're going to be requiring the developers. They have to offer Sign In with Apple as an option where you use your iCloud account. Now, you've already got your phone, you've already got your iPad, you've already got your MacBook. Those things you have to have an iCloud account to be able to get into any of those things. And you can still provide your email address to them. But one of the things that they do is they have a thing set up where they will create kind of like a fake email address that is essentially a proxy to your email address. And so let's say, for example, when I go to log into an app, I don't have to log in with my Facebook account. I can log in my Apple account. And you say, well, what's the difference? The difference is that the company that I'm logging into, they don't get a real email address, and they don't know, they know that someone logged in, but there's nothing that ties it back to them. And if I ever want to really like nuke that company and say, you know, don't ever contact me again, that email address gets nuked because it's got some weird kind of like
GUID.
It's like a GUID. It's an interesting thing that they're doing. You have the option where you can provide, you know, your real email address to them, but when the company contacts you, it goes through this fake email address back to you. I'm curious to see how this is implemented and if they're just going to require it, if they're only going to allow it just for like apps on your phone, or if they're going to allow it for anything. And so I'm curious, like on my email list that I set up, am I going to see some of these bogus email address showing up inside of my mailing list? I'm really, when this thing rolls out, I'm really curious to see how this gets used.
Yeah, yeah. Microsoft account used to be like this. So years and years ago, if you did sign in using your Live ID at the time, I think it was, right, into an app, into a third-party app, the data that you got back and the token that you received was anonymized. Mm. And so if you made an app and I made an app separately, and then somebody signed into your app, and then that same somebody signed into my app, the user identifier that you would get would be different from the user identifier that I would get. Mm. And the goal there was to stop sites collaborating with one another and seeing who is also using both sites, and also targeting users with like ads based on where else on the web they were going and signing into stuff. So yeah, it's an interesting concept. It's not new, right? It's a new take on it, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do quite like the idea. Anything that puts me more in control of what data I give to people when I sign into stuff. You know, with Google and with Facebook now, when you sign into sites, there's a little link and it's like, you know, change what you give them. And there's some, you can see what's mandatory that the site needs, and then what's optional. And I always go in and uncheck all the optional stuff, like my friends list and my birth date and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But I bet 99% of people don't do that.
Mm. I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I would like, as somebody who uses this kind of stuff for marketing, I use a lot of Voitano. I'll be honest. I like this kind of information. It's useful to me, and I'm able to target people, but I look at it as a perspective of, I only want to target people who would be potentially interested in what I have to sell. And if you're not interested, then I want to get you off my list as fast as I can. But I think one of the things that's a little challenging about it, I think from a personal perspective, from the consumer point of view, I don't mind advertisers. Maybe they can't tie it to Andrew, but I don't mind them being able to see things that I'm doing implicitly, to be able to say that you're interested in these things. Like if you're reading these blog posts, if you're watching these videos, if you're inside of these groups in Facebook, then hey, you like SharePoint development. I'd like to talk to you. I don't care that your name is Chris Johnson. I just would like to show you an ad for that kind of thing. If you make all of this stuff completely anonymized, then you don't be able to pick up those kind of trends and say, I think you might be interested in something like this. And part of me looks at it and says, that's disappointing, because now it's more like advertising goes closer to like the billboard on the side of the road. That's just mass. Like, I'm just going to throw something out there and 90% of people that see this don't give a damn. And it's not effective. It's not efficient. And part from the business owner, I'm irritated by it because it's not effective. It's just a waste of money. But I'm also a little irritated by it because I don't want to sell SharePoint training to my mom. I don't want to get an ad in front of my mom for that stuff.
No, but I think this is already happening, right? Like when you put an ad on Facebook, you don't get a list of people who saw it.
I don't, but I guess my point is that I didn't finish that thought. I don't get a list of the people who saw it, and nor do I really care about the list of people who saw it. I just care that someone came to my site and ultimately said, here's my information, ultimately told me, but I want to make sure that Facebook has that information to be able to put that picture in front of people.
Oh, sure. Yeah, to target the right people. Yeah, I think that's...
And the thing that concerns me is that when, as we're moving more and more to so much more of this like militant side of the privacy side, where we're going so far to the other end of the spectrum, which I think we'll get there and then we'll kind of come back a little bit. We're going to go to this other end of the spectrum where everything you do is so anonymized that there is no way to do things that are a little more targeted. Like, I give you a very joking example to this, but it's true. My wife was seeing ads on Facebook for stuff that there is absolutely no way that she would buy because she's a woman.
Yeah.
And and I know someone's like going, what kind of sites is your wife going to? I'm like, no, it was not that. They just started showing up one day and it was that from one company, and it was absolutely hilarious that she was being targeted for this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, as a consumer, I want ads that if I'm going to see ads, I want ones that might interest me.
Yeah.
Anywho. All right. On slightly further, Oracle and Microsoft are teaming up apparently to take on Amazon. So Oracle and Microsoft said last week that they're agreeing to make their two cloud computing services work together. And by that, they mean in this particular case, they're doing like what I imagine is high capacity bandwidth and networking between their data centers. And when you think about it, that makes sense, right? Because lots of enterprises have cloud computing requirements from Oracle and also from Microsoft with Azure, right? They've obviously got Oracle databases and all that sort of stuff. They might want to run that in Oracle Cloud. They might want to run the rest in Azure. And it'd be nice to have a nice offering that works really well between those two. They see that as a selling point against AWS, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Huh.
Yeah, it just makes it more attractive for those companies moving to the cloud with Oracle workloads.
That's cool. I have two quick links that I'm going to throw out there. One because it's kind of funny and one is interesting. I know this is going to really screw you up, or I know it screwed you up since June the 1st, CJ, because the consumer version of BlackBerry Messenger shut down on May the 31st. So, sorry. Yep, see, can't even talk because you lost your messaging. The other one I found is...
In other news, the grass is green.
Another article that I have here, and this is a couple weeks old, and I've thought about making... This is actually about a month and a half old. And I've wanted to bring this up, and I don't mean this as a negative side. I just kind of find it as interesting tech. And I don't want people to think that this is like an Azure kind of slam, because I think some of the data that's inside of this post, you don't get the full picture of what was going on. And a lot of stuff could have played an impact to this. But I still find it interesting that the GitLab, which is kind of like a compete to GitHub, GitLab, they migrated from their cloud provider being from Azure over to the Google Cloud platform. And they explained their whole story about how they did it, why they did it, or not the why, how they did it, and then how they did it with like zero downtime, how they did a complete cutover, zero downtime. And it talks about some of the performance reasons of impacts that they saw. This is the part that I think you don't get the full picture, because they talk about, you know, hey, look at how much faster things were, but then when we switched over. But then there's another part in the article where it kind of says, we did rewrite some stuff while we were doing the migration. It's like, well, that couldn't have had an impact on either platform. So,
Yeah, they did do a big sort of, I wouldn't say a re-architecture at the time, but they did make a lot of changes to their application along the way.
Yeah.
And there's been people say, hey, you could have done that and stayed on Azure and you would have been just as well off. So,
yeah, that's interesting. Hey, before we move on, we got some other Microsoft news here. But before we move on, let's have another word from one of our fantastic sponsors that makes this segment of the show possible.
If you could score an extra hour or two back in your day, would you take it? Because our friends over at Nintex want to give you a gift. The gift of time. Seriously, if you haven't checked out what Nintex has to offer lately, you should. The platform built on Azure has evolved a lot. In just the past few months, the Nintex team has added new process mapping capabilities, and most recently, a new e-sign capability called Nintex Sign, powered by Adobe Sign. Nintex also continues to revolutionize products you know and trust, including Nintex Workflow and Forms. With the power of Nintex, it is faster and easier for you to configure, not code, giving you valuable time back every day to spend it however you want. Test drive the Nintex Process Cloud at Nintex.com.
Okay, CJ, would you like to pick out one of our Microsoft-related newsy things?
Yes. What is the most hated piece of software from Apple in the world?
iTunes.
Yes. What are they doing with iTunes?
Killing it?
Getting rid of it. Yes. What's the second most hated piece of software from Apple on Windows?
The phone. Oh, on the phone. Or on the Windows.
Yes, the iCloud integration. I'll save you save your thoughts. It is such a diabolical turd of a piece of software. Anyway, they recently announced a new version of iCloud for Windows 10 that they're distributing through the store. And Paul Thurrott has a really interesting article about this. It's pretty interesting. It looks pretty good, I should say. But B, and what is even, this is the fascinating part, is Apple have decided to piggyback on some of the same stuff that's in Windows 10 that powers the OneDrive files on demand integration to do the same with their iCloud integration. So now when you use iCloud on Windows 10, it uses some of that same OneDrive file on demand sync technology that OneDrive uses. Interesting, eh?
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm guessing so that, you know, when you hook up to iCloud, you don't necessarily have to download everything and you can do the file on demand stuff from iCloud. He sort of points out that I'm pretty sure this is the first to do this. So yeah, it's kind of a nice update for those iOS users that use iCloud and are also Windows users.
Huh, that's pretty cool. I'm noticing some interesting stuff with OneDrive on macOS that looks like I'm not the only one. OneDrive on macOS likes to use a lot of memory.
Yeah, I can't say I've noticed.
Yeah, like a lot. Like yesterday I was like, why is my machine all like just going so slow? And I pulled it up and OneDrive was consuming 7 gigs. I'm like, wait a minute, Chrome's only using a gig. So something's definitely up here.
Yeah, something's definitely wrong if Chrome is the lowest user of RAM.
Yeah, and I killed it and I started back up again and it's already back up to 1.9 gigs right now. So I found an Outlook's at a gig, Chrome's at a gig, but anyway.
Yeah, I look at my process monitor and if Chrome isn't using at least 2 or 3 gigs of RAM, I wonder if what's broken. It's almost the opposite problem of like, what's happened? Did I reboot recently? Oh, maybe my machine rebooted. Yeah, something like that. Anyway, I jest. But yeah, okay. So yeah, iCloud for Windows 10, you go check it out.
I've got another article here from the Microsoft security blog from early in June. For those of you who manage, do anything like detailed with email in terms of like managing your email infrastructure, there's a bunch of security things that are set up with email to really cut down on spam. And there's something called DMARC. DMARC stands for Domain Message Authentication Reporting and Conformance. And essentially what it does is it's a configuration in your email and in your DNS that allows, like, if I send you an email, CJ, your mail servers can look at the domain that it came from and ensure that it's a legit domain, and there's some other stuff that kind of kicks into it. You can set this stuff up on your own. If you have these things set up, it can cut down on a lot of your email going to like junk filters or stuff like that. But to set it up, it can be a little bit of a challenge. And then one of the things that you do is that if your mail gets like sandboxed, then by an external service, then you can get this reporting, you get these email reports kind of sent to you, but they're all kind of messy and stuff. What's kind of cool about this is that Microsoft has teamed up with a service or a tool called Valley Mail Monitor. They have a service now for Valley Mail Monitor for Office 365. And what it does, it's a fully automated service, free of charge. And what it does is it allows you to easily see third-party services that are sending mail on your behalf. So like if you're doing something that sends an email through your domain,
yeah,
as well as potential imposters that are trying to spoof your brand, and eliminates the need for you to wade through lots of big XML-based reports. Those are the reports that I get today for my mail, because like I have an external service, SendGrid, send email out to my customers using my domain. But now with this, by these reports configuring the DNS to go to this service, I now get a really good, clean way of looking at this and saying, top senders, where did it come from? Office 365, or hey, this came from SendGrid, or this came from these other domains that don't make a whole lot of sense. And then I can then go in and I can do some configuration to tell your mail server, or I tell my mail server that's going to tell yours when it queries it, that says, hey, if the mail came from these IPs, it didn't come from me. It's invalid stuff. It's a cool free service that Microsoft is adding for customers with Office 365. And to me, what it really shows is, you know, Office 365 really growing up for businesses, for enterprise email.
Yeah, I think this is really cool. Like if you send email as part of an application or what have you, this will be invaluable. because it is a pain.
It takes 5 minutes to set this up.
You wonder why email bounces or gets marked as junk. This is probably it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool. All right, I've got one Slack for Outlook. Yeah, Slack have launched a set of Outlook add-ins that let you clutter up your Slack feeds with shit from email. Sorry. Sorry, I couldn't help it.
Excuse Is this like friend. Teamifying your Slack?
Yeah, yeah. So just when you thought there wasn't enough junk in Slack already, you could go stuff all your email in there too. There's really a couple of, I sort of half jest. There's a couple of add-ins. One is to get email messages into Slack so that you can escalate a conversation from Outlook into Slack. So there's an Outlook add-in that will help you do that. And then there's another Outlook add-in for Slack, an add-in for Slack that will let you deal with calendar appointments. It'll send you reminders in Slack when you've got Outlook calendars appointments coming up. You can accept or decline meetings through Slack, like a Slackbot type thing, stuff like that. That one seems more interesting to me than moving an email into Slack, but I understand why some people would want to escalate an email into Slack. I don't think it goes the other direction, though. This is interesting because Slack are obviously saying, hey, yeah, a lot of business gets done on email, and we want a piece of that action, make it easier to people move those conversations into Slack. So I'm not surprised they've done it.
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think the calendaring one is more interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, it's not I'm a target audience for that. Putting more stuff in there, I think that's the part that kind of moves things in the wrong direction. So
yeah, yeah. Cool.
We had two other quick Microsoft ones we'll throw out there. One is article related to the Azure SQL Server database tier that you can now do hyperscale. I talked to somebody about this who said this is huge. I'm like, oh, I get it's huge. And now you can hyperscale up to 100 terabytes, which is, that's for a very specific kind of a customer. They even have a part on, well, who should consider doing this and how's the pricing model work? It's a new capability that's now supported by Azure SQL Server. I have another one where by Brendan Burns that was from early May. Now, this really kind of goes along with some of the announcements from Build.
I think we may have talked about this one in the past.
Oh, had we? I know you had mentioned the key to the Kubernetes event-driven auto-scaling, but...
GA of virtual nodes, for sure. It may have been on one of those episodes that you weren't on.
Well,
I don't remember. It was a while back. But hey, let's remind people.
Emphasizing the Kubernetes. There we
go. Good call.
Hey, you got time for some picks today?
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's hear it. I have another word from one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back to the picks.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
CJ, do you want to pick first?
Sure. I'm going to space.
What?
Well, yeah, not yet. NASA is opening the space station to tourists for $35,000 a night. So you can go book a room on the ISS for $35,000 a night. Of course, getting there is the hard part. And that's up to you. That might cost you $30 million to get there. But once you're there, it's only $35,000 a night. There are hotels in Vegas that cost that. So I think you could go up there and have the best view in the world for the same price as a really sweet suite in Vegas. Yeah. $35,000, I thought that was pretty reasonable, actually. That includes food, meals, beverages, and a great view.
Internet?
Yes, internet. Yeah, no, but you do pay. You do pay $50 a gigabyte extra for internet.
Really?
Yes.
They should charge more.
$50 a gig for data. I thought that was pretty funny. But you do get life support communications and some other things. Yeah.
That's a feature that it would be nice to add in Vegas, have life support on my hotel bill.
Yeah, I'd love that as an optional extra.
Yeah.
Yeah, so getting there is the tough part. It might cost you $20 to $30 million, depending on who you go with. But hey, who knows, when SpaceX are doing their thing, that price might come down. We'll see.
Mike always does. I have a pick. This was really interesting. You've always, you know how you got like these different state lotteries and things where you can go, always seem like a bit of a scam. Like the money you go through and you get a scratch off ticket or you put the six numbers in and it's like, oh, you know, am I going to make, I could make, you know, $50 million. I can make this much. There is an elderly couple. Where were they from again? I think they were in, Minnesota. They figured out, the man figured out how to, oh, Michigan. There you go. He figured out how to crack a couple of different state lotteries and has made over $26 million.
Holy smoke.
So
how do you do that?
Okay. So let me give you the gist of it. It's a game. He spotted a game. He started doing this back in 2003 and he's been doing it since. So he walked into a corner store, saw a brochure for a game called Windfall, and it's a little different. This game has a thing called Roll Down. And so unlike Mega Millions, you probably heard of these games where you the jackpot can keep just going bigger and bigger and bigger until someone hits all six numbers and they win it.
Yeah.
Windfall, if the jackpot reaches 5 million and no one matches all six numbers, all of the money rolls down to the lower prize tiers, dramatically boosting the payouts to those who match five numbers or four numbers or three numbers. He did all the math for this. He sees when these things go to, when the it hits 5 million bucks, and he goes through and buys a bunch of tickets. And so like there's a story here where he bought $3,600 in Windfall tickets and won $6,300. Then he turned around and found another one where he bet $8,000 and made $16,000. So he's getting like anywhere from 20% to 60% return on his investments. And he's even, so much so, he's even started his own corporation and started selling shares in it where other people can give him a couple thousand dollars and he still goes off and does this for other people.
It's basically an investment strategy.
He's going through, and so this article goes through and it, with the reporter sat down with him. He pulled out all of his books for the corporation. It's called GS Investment Strategies. Stacks of record books that details their winnings. He's like, here's one that was pretty successful. We played $515,000 and got back $853,000.
That's awesome.
Isn't it cool?
That's clever.
Yeah. So that's my pick for the week.
That's crazy. That's awesome. I love stories like that. It's funny. I bet it's not going to last for long. They're going to change the rules.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Now they figured it out. And now for a fun one. This is a listener pick from Rob Windsor, good friend of ours. Rob, you are definitely getting a solo key for your video on YouTube that it looks like it was a video from on YouTube from Bloomberg that talks about a new company called Stitch. It's tender for the 50 plus crowd.
Interesting.
Don't swipe too far to the right or too far to the left. You might break a hip.
Yeah. Is this real?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a 5-minute interview and it's funny. It's a funny interview though. But like there's a woman that's in there that is doing the interview that she's getting flamed quite a bit on the in the comments.
I'm gonna have to watch that. That's funny.
Yeah.
I thought Tinder for plus 50s was like a bar. Isn't that what people used to do?
That's what they used to. Remember, we're old though, CJ.
I'm not 50 yet, buddy.
I didn't say you were 50 yet.
What about, anyway.
Before me.
True. I'll let you know what it's like. Hopefully I won't need Tinder at that point, but we'll see.
Don't piss the key off.
That's right. Yeah. Classic. Cool. All right.
Yeah, good episode this week. And I guess we'll be syncing up again next week.
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool deal, man. All right.
Catch up.
See you later, everybody.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as an MP3 or WAV file and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.